Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. On this day before taxes are due, we will begin with a comparison of what people pay in terms of personal income tax with what corporations pay. Scott Klinger, the Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity, joins us. He has an article at The Nation, Six Rigged Rules Corporations Use to Dodge Taxes. Then we'll revisit the European debt crisis that many thought had been dealt with, but Spain is now facing unsustainable borrowing costs as unemployment soars to Great Depression levels and youth unemployment remains at over 50%. Economist Stephanie Griffith-Jones joins us to discuss what Nobel economist Joe Stiglitz refers to as Europe's economic suicide pact. She is the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. Then finally, we will speak about Mitt Romney's Mormon faith and its egalitarian, classless, utopian roots. Troy Williams, the executive producer of Radioactive, a progressive talk show on KRCL-FM in Salt Lake City, joins us to discuss his article at Salon, When Mormons Were Socialists. Joining us now is Scott Klinger, who is the Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity. He is a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. He has an article at The Nation, Six Rigged Rules Corporations Use to Dodge Taxes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Klinger.
Good afternoon, Ian. How are you?
Well, I'm well, and I imagine a lot of our listeners are bracing for tomorrow's deadline on filing their income taxes. And I guess if they knew how crooked and rigged the system is, we may have a tax revolt on our hands.
Yeah, it's interesting to think, you know, there's this Tea Party out there, and, you know, we certainly could get a good rebellion going against the ways corporations get out of their paying their taxes.
So give us some of the broad strokes then from your the six rigged rules corporations use to dodge taxes. And, of course, these rules were written by the Congress, which is owned by the corporations.
That's right. Congress is fiercely lobbied on all sorts of issues, but tax issues are one of the most significant ones. And what we did is we looked at six rules that deliver great benefits to corporations that aren't available to middle-class taxpayers. So, for example, one of the rules was AIG, when they got bailed out in 2008, they were allowed to keep all of those losses, even though taxpayers paid for all of them, and now they're using those losses to offset their profits and not pay taxes. So those kinds of things that we think make the public mad. And so we profiled these things. They cost the American Treasury hundreds of billions of dollars a year. So at the same time, we're told we're broke and we have to cut all these programs that many people depend on. We're giving hundreds of billions of dollars of tax breaks to corporations.
Well, some, you know, there are good corporations and bad corporations, and it's, you know, at least in terms of the public perceptions, I think the 99% movement has isolated and identified some of the more socially irresponsible and predatory corporations. They're going to be picketing a bunch of shareholder meetings, starting with Bank of America in the spring. But most Americans, I think, have a fairly benign attitude towards Apple because, after all, they do produce goods and products that people actually want, which is not like what Wall Street does, which is extract wealth for themselves as opposed to create wealth, which is what they're supposed to be doing. Yet you've revealed in an article recently, Scott Klinger, that Apple, in fact, as its accountants are as good as its engineers and project designers and product designers.
Well, that's right. Apple is one of many technology companies and pharmaceutical companies that takes advantage of a lot of what's called transfer pricing loopholes, in which they can legally shift some of their profits overseas to countries that don't charge any taxes or very low taxes, countries we call tax haven countries. And the way they do that is they register some of their patents in those countries, and then when they use the patents, they charge a very high dollar amount for the use of the patent, arguing that the product wouldn't be any good if it didn't have that intellectual property in it. And in doing that, they transfer the profits out of the U.S. into the country like Ireland or the Netherlands, which have very low tax rates on corporate royalties and corporate intellectual property. And then they leave all the costs back in the United States, so they get big deductions for their management and advertising and research costs and those sorts of things. So one of the things we did when we looked at Apple was that we found that their profit margin in the United States was just 24 cents on every dollar of sales, and overseas it was 36 cents, which just doesn't make any sense, especially since Apple has so many stores, retail stores in the United States that they don't have overseas. So they're actually capturing more of the profit out of the whole sales cycle in America, and yet their profit margin is about 50% less in the United States than it is internationally.
So, Scott Klinger, the Buffett rule is up for debate now. Of course, it's going to be dead on arrival.
It was voted on already, and it failed 51-48, I think.
So, it's obviously a political signal, right, that the president is sending, he recently paid. I think he pays more taxes than his secretary, and he made a point of that. And of course, we know that Mitt Romney pays his 2010 tax rate was 13.9%, and of course, Buffett's tax rate is 17.4%. Obviously, much lower than his secretary's, this famous secretary of his. What's your sense of whether that? Obviously, the president's trying to make a political point. But is it resonating in this country? Are we in the thrall of millionaires and billionaires, or is there some egalitarian stirrings going on out there?
Well, I think it's starting to shift. For 20 years, we've been told that millionaires and billionaires and corporations are the job creators. And I think people are really starting to see what's really behind that. We see large companies continuing to lay off workers, to sit on record levels of cash and not hire and not build new factories. And now we see increasing evidence that big businesses aren't paying their taxes and rich people aren't paying their taxes. I remember, a decade ago when a lot of conservatives were calling for a flat tax. Well, we have worse than that right now. We have people with seven-figure and up incomes paying less of their income in taxes than middle-class families. And I think that's where the rebellion and the anger comes from. It's not American. It's not fair. Even Rush Limbaugh at one point criticized GE for not paying taxes when one of the Occupy people called his station. He got flustered and he said, he was upset that GE didn't pay too.
Because GE is also the parent of MSNBC.
you never know. But anyway, I'm on all kinds of radio shows across the political spectrum, and one thing I think conservatives and liberals can agree on, it's not fair when big businesses make millions and billions of dollars of profit and don't pay taxes. That's a pretty universal American value.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Scott Klinger, who is the Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity. He's a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. And he has an article at The Nation, Six Rigged Rules Corporations Use to Dodge Taxes. Yesterday, I spoke with David K. Johnston, who's considered one of the leading experts on taxes, who pays them and who doesn't in this country. And he has an article at Reuters revealing that 2,700 U.S. corporations have managed to get state governments to withhold the state taxes which they withhold for their employees, but then to hand that money over to these corporations, which struck me as being almost futile. I can't believe that a corporation is getting the tax money from its employees, and the employees aren't getting any benefit, but the corporation is getting an enormous state subsidy.
Yeah, it is futile, and the title of the report that he wrote that on is from a group called Good Jobs First, and the report is called "Paying Taxes to the Boss," which I think says it all. That thousands of employees around the country are dutifully paying their withholding taxes to support their schools and their fire departments and infrastructure, bridges and highways and things like that. And that money is really going to build factories and probably even buy new carpet for the corner office. I think that's something that people don't know about. And I certainly didn't know about it before I read about it. And I think it's just another example of how far things have gone. We were talking about Apple a second ago, and one of the things Apple just announced, they were building a $300 million new American operations facility in Austin, Texas. And they're getting something like $28 million of state and local funding to do that. The state of Texas is kicking in $20 million. At the same time, they're cutting their education budget $4 billion and laying off 100,000 teachers. So, you know, where's that tax money going? It's going into the pockets of wealthy companies that already have so much, and our kids and seniors and those people that depend on infrastructure, small businesses and others are being hurt.
So, Scott Klinger, are we a government of the corporation, by the corporation, and for the corporation?
It seems that way. You know, things don't really seem to be turning around. It's hard to imagine that the Senate today would not even allow a vote on the Buffett rule. It's not that it didn't pass. It's that it was blocked with a filibuster because 49 senators believe that that rich people shouldn't have to pay their fair share.
And this is how partisan was the vote?
I didn't see the senator by senator breakdowns. I just saw the headline, but I assume it fell kind of along party lines. And obviously, I think some of the Democrats probably voted against it too, or else it would have had more votes.
Right. Well, do you think, though, that given that the president is, you know, he must have known he was going to lose. I think he might have been even surprised that he didn't even get a hearing in the Senate. It is, after all, controlled for the Democrats. That in itself is pretty shocking. But do you think it's going to be a viable campaign issue? I guess somebody's got to take up this cause, don't they?
Well, I think inequality is a huge issue, and the Occupy movement has highlighted it, held it up, and people it's resonating with people. I think people are understanding that it's not their own failures that have led them to be losing their houses or struggling to pay their bills, or, you know, see soaring costs for college education, have young people graduate from college with enormous debts and can't find a good job. It's the system that's rigged, and it's, as you said, corporations have taken over our Congress, and we have a government that's run for corporations and people in the 1%. And until people start voting for different elected officials that don't support those kinds of ways of looking at things, then I think we'll continue down the same path. But I think people are waking up, and I think we'll see a lot this spring with kind of a renewed sense of conversation and street protests and some of the stuff going on in shareholder meetings you mentioned. I think we'll see this in the news right up to the election.
So, but what can be done, though, to combat and reverse the economic illiteracy? Because, for example, I often hear on television and you see it in the newspapers that, American corporations pay the highest corporate tax in the world, like 35%. This is used as a kind of mantra to suggest that how overtaxed we are, and it turns out that statistics are pretty clear that the U.S. is across the board, all taxes included, is one of the lowest taxed nations. I think it's around 30 of the industrial nations in terms of how low its taxes are. So, you know, the truth of the matter is that U.S. corporations don't pay the 35% tax rate. That may well be the rate, but the average apparently is 12.1%. How do you get this data out? I mean, I just sometimes feel frustrated that we've reached a point in the country so polarized and so education is so poor, and the media is so derelict in its having any sense of moral of social responsibility to educate the public. You have a hard time with a lot of people just don't accept data.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly live in an era where facts don't matter as much as they used to. But I think taxes are a really important issue. Taxes are one of the major reasons why changes in our tax rates are one of the major reasons why we've seen this economic divide that we've seen of the rich getting so much richer and the middle class suffering and dwindling and poor people worse of all. So I think, you know, my encouragement to your listeners would be to look beyond the soundbite. When someone says something, question it. And there's a lot more resources online than there used to be. One really good piece of news was the Pulitzer Prizes came out today, and one of the New York Times reporters, David Karchineski, won a Pulitzer Prize for his tax reporting. That's something we don't see every day. So I think that there's a recognition that this sort of information is important. And it's also important as we're facing all these cuts in government, as we're seeing our kids' class sizes go up in school, as we're seeing politicians telling us we have to cut our Social Security and our Medicare. So, you know, if you care about those things, you know, put aside your aversion about numbers and read a couple of articles to have a different perspective on taxes and talk about them, you know, wherever you're with other people, in your churches or your union halls or, you know, wherever you get together with people, you know, strike up a conversation and try and learn more together.
Well, you just mentioned numbers. Learn some numbers, Scott Klinger. In the 1950s, corporate federal income taxes accounted for nearly one-third of federal government revenues. In 2011, corporate taxes accounted for less than 8%.
Yeah, that explains the deficit right there, and then some. If corporations were paying what they used to pay, we would be in a very different fiscal situation today, and we wouldn't be talking about having to make these dramatic cuts to social programs and infrastructure and all the other things we're talking about cutting.
But you would think, though, that corporations would recognize the kind of infrastructure decay going on in this country, the neglect, the defunding of education, which has led to the dumbing down of America. Don't they want roads and electricity? They all share them, too. Don't they want an educated workforce?
Well, it's you'd think so. I mean, it seems very short-sighted to have all these things. And one of the constant complaints we hear about corporations is there's not enough educated people to do the jobs that they need. So I kind of look at that and go, whose fault is that? Who's not been paying their taxes? Who's not been supporting the systems that we used to have, the educated people? I was with a small business owner yesterday, a couple days ago, at a press conference, and he repairs church organs. And he talked about when he started his business 20 years ago, all the young people who came looking for jobs had both music training in schools and shop class. So they knew how to work with wood and repair things. He says today people show up that none of them have had music in school and none of them have had shop. And so he has to train them all himself, and it's a great expense. So that's a very tangible way that one business is suffering because of the shift in priorities that we've seen because we're always trying to cut our taxes and do things on the cheap.
Well, it's an odd situation that it takes billionaires and this group of patriotic millionaires to tell the American people, and the president does this, by the way, he keeps saying, I don't need a tax break, you know, I'm doing quite well. It's so odd that it somehow, you know, people don't seem to understand this basic outrage.
Well, the majority of Americans support the Buffett rule and support raising taxes on millionaires, and even a pretty solid chunk of millionaires support it. I think something in the 40% think that a Buffett rule makes sense. So, it's not even that our rules are being rigged by, you know, the whole 1% or all rich people. It's a pretty narrow band that is pulling the triggers and bending the rules and all of this stuff.
Well, Scott Klinger, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Klinger, who's the Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity. He's a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. He has an article at The Nation, 6 Rigged Rules Corporations Used to Dodge Taxes. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the crisis in Spain. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, who is currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. She's the author of the book, Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephanie Griffiths-Jones.
It's a pleasure to be here. Such a good program.
Well, thank you so much, Stephanie. And today's New York Times is quite an alarming piece by Nobel laureate Paul Krugman, Europe's Economic Suicide, where he says European leaders, there's an apparent determination of European leaders to commit economic suicide for the continent as a whole. And at the end of his article, he says that they seem determined to drive their economy and their society off a cliff, and the whole world will pay the price. Do you share his alarm, Stephanie?
Well, yes, I think that this diagnosis is correct, and so are his proposals, because I think this idea that you can impose major fiscal austerity on countries is completely crazy. It's bad arithmetic, it ignores the lessons of history, and it's bad economics. It's bad arithmetic because if you lower debt to reduce fiscal spending at a time when the private sector is too scared to increase its own spending, you will lower growth and you will lower GDP, and your ratio of debt to GDP will actually go up as you start trying to reduce it. Secondly, it ignores the lessons of history, because this is what was done in the 1930s. This is what we have been trying to avoid, and they're falling into the same trap. And it's bad economics, because Keynes thought of this, as Joe Stiglitz has said it, and now Krugman is very clearly saying that you cannot lower aggregate demand further as a way of solving a debt crisis. What Europe needs and the world needs, more growth. And if you impose fiscal austerity, you will not have growth.
Well, at this point, Spain seems to be teetering, and the statistics on Spain are, first of all, the cost of their borrowing has reached over 6%, which is unsustainable. My understanding is that German bonds are, about 1.78 or something by comparison. Spain has 23.6% unemployment, which is comparable to what happened here in the Great Depression. Youth unemployment is over 50%. But my understanding is that most of it comes from the bursting of the housing bubble, which was generated by German capital from German banks, largely for German people buying second homes in Spain. And it seems that the Spaniards are paying the price. Can you walk us through this?
Well, I don't think we can just blame the German banks, although they were certainly responsible. But I think the Spanish authorities did not control the housing bubble. It's an interesting question why they had some counter-cyclical regulations, which is good, on the banks, but they did not control lending in real estate. And in so many cases, this has ended in tears. What is interesting to point out is that Spain actually had a fiscal surplus in 2007, and it is only as a result of the crisis in Europe and its effort to have Keynes policies that its debt and its deficit has grown so much. I think, as you mentioned Germany, I think it's very important to say that you can deal with these problems in two ways, as Keynes taught us. You can either deflate the better economies, or you could expand growth in the countries that have more surpluses, that have more policy space. And this is exactly the case, because Germany could increase real wages, could increase fiscal spending, and could therefore lead to higher growth in Europe, which would help countries like Spain to export more and therefore have lower unemployment. And secondly, European leaders should be much more imaginative. They have, for example, a big European public bank, European Investment Bank, and they could expand it, say double the capital, double its lending to SMEs, for infrastructure in countries like Spain, in countries like Greece, and this could create more aggregate demand, and they could do that without major increases in fiscal deficit. So it's just applying the right economics, which is increasingly difficult, but there is still policy space, and they should just do it.
Well, aren't they, the European Central Bank, obsessed by inflation? And I think you're arguing that they need a little bit of inflation.
Well, inflation would be good, but above all, I mean, I think the European Central Bank has moved forward. It has been providing a lot of liquidity, which has been helpful for avoiding problems in the private banks. But beyond that, you then have to have some kind of fiscal response. And, of course, these countries like Spain in the periphery cannot do that alone. Some of that heavy lifting has to be done by the German economy and to a certain extent also by the British economy, which also has some fiscal space. And it's not just me or more progressive academics saying it. I just heard a speech by the head of Western Hemisphere of the IMF arguing for more fiscal expansion in Europe. So there's quite a lot of consensus among good economists. It's just that the politicians in Europe are captured in what Stiglitz calls this collective suicide pact, which is to cut, which further undermines growth, which then scares the financial market. Because financial markets are not just scared of the debt, they're also scared of the lack of growth, of the high unemployment, as you say, of potential political tensions that may arise. If you gave some hope to the countries, to the young people, for jobs, and the banks could respond more positively.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, the economist who's currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. She's the author of the book Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. We're talking yet again, I have to say, Stephanie, I feel like I've had this conversation a number of times over the last couple of years about Europe's inability to get its hands around its debt situation, to build the sufficient firewalls, to deal with the North-South divide, which is pretty clear and growing. And here we are back again having the same conversation. And of course, the subtext for this conversation is if there is a crisis in the Eurozone, it's bound to affect the U.S. economy and impact the very, very fragile recovery that we're going through. And, of course, that will have enormous political repercussions for Barack Obama's re-election.
I think you're quite right. I mean, the U.S. economy is beginning to recover, even though in a fragile way. Unemployment is going down, which is very positive. And the last thing that the U.S. economy needs and the Obama campaign is a big storm coming from Europe. So the U.S. administration has to put pressure, particularly on the Germans, but also on the British, for a more expansionary fiscal policy accompanying a more relaxed monetary policy. And it's not just for the U.S., it's also for the rest of the world, because what will happen to developing countries if there's a full-blown European crisis? If Spain is unable to refinance its debt through the banks, what will happen to the European banking system, which is interconnected with the banks of the rest of the world? What will happen if European aggregate demand collapses? And so we need a bigger firewall, as you say, but above all, we need more expansionary fiscal policies and higher increases in real wages in Germany. I mean, Germany is very keen on its competitiveness with China, which is important, but it also sells a lot to Europe and trades a lot with Europe. So if real wages in Germany were to increase, then real wages in Spain wouldn't have to fall. And it becomes a positive sum game rather than a negative sum game as it's being played now. And you know, surely we need to learn the lessons from the Great Recession, from the great Latin American debt crisis of the 80s. We do not want to have a lost decade for growth in Europe. We do not want to have the risk of political tensions increasing as they did in the 1930s. Surely, you know, as Toynbee said, those who do not learn from history are destined to repeat it. But we do not want to repeat the horrors of the 1930s and the 1940s. And therefore, we need to have good economists doing reasonable things before it's too late.
So what explains this constant inability of the Eurozone, particularly the bigger players, Germany and France, to get their hands around this ongoing crisis. They delay and they dither and they eventually deal with things too late and it becomes much more expensive, which is the case with the Greek situation and now similar situation with Spain. And you've just made a very eloquent case, and I'm sure other economists in Europe have made this case, and I'm sure that Geithner with the U.S. Treasury has made this case. What explains the resistance? Why is it that we have this cycle, this pattern of inability to get their hands around this crisis, this ongoing, it's about the third year we're talking about now. That's the part of it that I find mystifying, that the gulf between economic realities and political possibilities.
I think you're quite right. I mean, it is very difficult to defend the policymakers. It is very difficult. It's not a single country like the United States, a different political interest. And it's a situation where financial markets and regulated financial markets and set finance, as we could call it, have become extremely powerful and are dictating the terms of the government. But I think also there is a lack of vision of the governments and a sort of narrow political way of dealing with things. Germans have always been very scared of inflation, and of course inflation is not really a major risk at the moment. The risk is deflation, and therefore it is this lack of vision of conservative governments that are scared. They're like a rabbit caught by headlights of an incoming car or a rapidly approaching car. And there is this lack of economic flexibility that, you know, this fiscal pact, which talks about more and more of the same, which is actually paralyzing the European government. But it is very difficult because they have allowed these financial markets to become so powerful, to have the power to dictate, what should these governments do. It's very interesting that actually François Hollande, the social democratic candidate, the socialist candidate, is talking about renegotiating the fiscal pact. It would naturally be delicate to do so, precisely because of the pressure of the market. But it would mean a first time that a political leader of an important European country would be pointing to the need for growth. He wants more expansionary policies, particularly in Germany. He wants, indeed, like we were talking, a far bigger role for the European Investment Bank. It's in his program. And if he was there, he might, if he does well in the election this Sunday and afterwards, he might change the tone of the debate.
Again, I speak with economist Stephanie Griffith-Jones, who's currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. So you mentioned the French socialist candidate for president and the possibility that he may get elected on Sunday. Is it this coming Sunday that the elections take place?
The first round is coming Sunday.
Yeah. So my understanding is that Sarkozy's economic policies have been absolutely disastrous, that he's in total denial and has been about what needs to be done, and he's been in this way for some time. What explains that?
Well, of course, Sarkozy is in a relatively weak position. He has his partnership with Merkel, and clearly Germany is the stronger partner. France has already seen its debt downgraded, and Sarkozy is not a man of vision. So he has been playing this kind of narrow crisis management game. All these summits and so on, but they do not resolve anything. I think what they need to do, as I said before, and as Krugman very clearly says it today in the paper, is to move towards a policy of far greater growth, of resolving the imbalances within Europe by expanding the growth of Germany. And this is, of course, not up to France only. It's mainly up to Germany, because France, I think, doesn't have the same policy space as Germany. Maybe it could expand a little bit, but they are also concerned about the loss of their credit rating. So it's basically Germany who can say we will save Europe, not only by putting money into this, but we will save Europe by by expanding our fiscal policy. And we have to tell the markets that this is the best way forward. And if Merkel had this kind of vision, then she would, instead of worrying about every single regional election, which she's been actually losing, this would be good for actually for the German economy. The problem is that the Germans don't feel the need to do this because actually the German economy is doing relatively well, unemployment is relatively low, but they need to do this for the rest of Europe because if not, their banks will suffer. And a European crisis is also bad for Germany and bad for German banks.
So it's been said that what Germany was unable to do militarily in the late 30s and 40s in Europe, they've succeeded to do economically in terms of dominating Europe. But if that analogy is true, why then would they literally throw away the fruits of victory? If they don't apparently recognize that even though they're doing well, their fate is tied to the rest of Europe?
I think that's right. I mean, I think these parallels in the Second World War are a little bit overdone, even though my family suffered a lot in the Second World War. But I think it's just basically lack of vision and bad economics, because they have this kind of, you know, like narrow housekeeping rule, like Margaret Thatcher had and Mrs. Merkel also, that you have to save more and balance your budget and so on. Mm-hmm. And they have done certain things which work for them, but they don't realize that it doesn't work collectively in a situation of crisis, and that they have to have, better economic analysis. They have to come back. So in Germany now, the Social Democrats, who may actually be going into government because Merkel's allies have been doing quite badly in recent elections, so there may be a great coalition now with the right, with the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats. And I think the Social Democrats have learned, and they are now propounding more Keynesian policy. So if you had a situation where Hollande won and where the Social Democrats went in Germany, you might have a change of balance in terms of economic policies, which could, I think, save the situation, one would hope.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Stephanie Griffiths-Jones.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, the economist who is currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. She's the author of the book, Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Mitt Romney's Mormon Church and their egalitarian socialist roots.
I believe that he sent his only son to die for my sins. And I believe that ancient Jews built boats and sailed to America. I am a Mormon, and a Mormon just believes. You cannot just believe.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Troy Williams, who is the executive producer of Radioactive, a progressive talk show on KRCL-FM in Salt Lake City. He is a former Mormon missionary who the Salt Lake Tribune recently named the gay mayor of Salt Lake City. He most recently appeared in the Errol Morris film Tabloid and has an article now at Salon, When Mormons Were Socialists. Welcome to Background Briefing, Troy Williams.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And I've tried to cover the religion aspect of Mitt Romney, and I imagine it will become an issue at some point or other if it hasn't already. And some of the information I initially got was pretty off the mark, that he was a Mormon bishop and that there's an analogy with the Catholic Church in as much as he may be more loyal to the Vatican, in this case the Salt Lake Vatican, and the prophet and his apostles. that's not necessarily the case, is it? Even though Romney did not take advantage of Jack Kennedy's separation of church and state speech, which Santorum said almost made him throw up, he right. nevertheless, as far as I know, is, let me ask you this. Do we have a church and state problem with Mitt Romney and his Mormonism?
I don't, not to the extent that I think people fear. We do have a church and state issue here in Utah, right? We like to joke here that the separation of church and state is just two city blocks from the Utah Capitol to the Salt Lake downtown Temple Square. But I think that what we have to understand is that Mormonism permeates every aspect of who Mitt Romney is. It cultivated and shaped who he is, was as a young boy and who he is as a man today. I don't think he's going to be answering to Thomas S. Monson, the current president or prophet of the church, but Mormonism will influence how he views the world. And in that respect, Mormonism will play a big part in the American culture if he is elected president.
Well, as much as I've been able to find out from some of the people who wrote books about him and from the Boston Globe and others who've known him for years, is that he's a bit of a stiff like Al Gore in terms of his public persona, but privately...
You haven't seen him unzipped, according to Ann Romney.
Well, my understanding is that within his Mormon milieu, he's a different person.
Yeah, and I don't know him personally, and I imagine, you know, that the public persona is very different from the actual human being, but it's hard to tell who the real human being is with Mitt Romney. He seems to be so politically malleable that he's hard to pin down. I don't even know if I can say how much of Mormonism he truly embraces. He certainly doesn't embrace the Book of Mormon admonitions to care for the poor and the needy when he supports Paul Ryan's budget plan that would slash $3.3 trillion from programs to benefit poor people. That to me is a completely anathema to what his spiritual sacred texts proclaim.
Well, let's talk about that. Troy Williams, again, executive producer of Radioactive, a progressive talk show on KRCL-FM in Salt Lake City. He has an article at Salon, When Mormons Were Socialists. Your article is fascinating, and not having read the Book of Mormon or studied it, I'm fascinated. The idea.
Have you seen the musical yet?
Well, exactly. But the idea is that there was this Nephite, is that how you pronounce it?
Pronounce it Nephite.
Nephite Nation that was somewhere in the American continent around 6 BC, and the inhabitants of this mythic city had grown decadent, and there were extreme class divisions, and politics were corrupt, and politicians were corrupt, and government disregarded the sick and the poor. And along comes Samuel the Lamanite, who scales the walls of this city of Zarahemla.
Zarahemla,
right. Well, you should tell the story since you're a Mormon.
It's a story that the Book of Mormon, of course, Joseph Smith translated it, or claimed to translate it in 1830, but it tells the history of supposedly of God's people living in ancient America that had migrated from Jerusalem in 600 B.C., and a mighty civilization grew up in Central and South America. That's the narrative of the Book of Mormon. But what is central to the text is what we call the Nephite pride cycle, that when the Nephites were a righteous people, God prospered them, gave them material wealth, but then they set their hearts upon their wealth. They disregarded the poor, shunned those who were hungry and in need and who were naked, and became prideful. And then God destroys them, delivers a small righteous remnant out of the destruction, and the story begins anew. This happens over and over and over again in the Book of Mormon, and it's alarming to a lot of Latter-day Saints who see this uber-capitalist who at Bain Capital employed a philosophy called creative destruction that was involved with layoffs and leveraged buyouts and just decimated the lives of so many people so that his investors could get wealthy. That's very alarming for a lot of Mormons to see.
Well, apparently the Mormon God's prophetic message was, if Americans are obedient to God, we will be blessed. blessed with riches. If Americans set our hearts on riches and ignore the poor, we'll be destroyed. That's the, I guess, the lesson that you just told us from this book of the unpronounceable names.
The Book of Mormon is an indictment against laissez-faire capitalism.
Well, that's...
Absolutely.
So, but what about the Mormon Church itself today? It's very corporate. These big corporations like Marriott and Safeco Insurance, it's hard to know where they begin and the church ends. And the tithing is, of course, an enormous source of money. And as you mentioned in your article, Troy Williams, at Salon.com, the church has diversified into commercial enterprises. They own television, radio stations, universities, farms, banks. And then they've gone into retail with some big new swanky mall, billion-dollar downtown Salt Lake City mall featuring Tiffany and Michael Kors and Porsche designs, etc. So explain to me what happened to God's admonition that you'll be destroyed if you don't help the poor.
Well, we're calling the brand new billion-dollar City Creek Mall, the locals here are already starting to call it Jesus Christ Superstore. it is a concern. In the Book of Mormon text, the prophet Moroni, and you'll see Moroni in all the Mormon temples, he's the golden angel with the horn on top of the spire of every Mormon temple that you see. There's one right downtown Los Angeles. Moroni, as he's like the last survivor of the Nephite people. He's the actual person who gives the golden plates to Joseph Smith. And he has a prophecy, a vision, where he foresees today. And he actually talks to us, and he says in the text, he says, I have seen your day, and I know your doing, and I know that you do walk after the pride of your hearts, and that you set your hearts upon riches. So it is a concern. This is so central to the text of the Book of Mormon that it is kind of ironic, it's deeply ironic, that this uber capitalist would be the first Mormon to actually get the nomination for a major political party. Because you have to roll back time. Early Mormons were communitarians. Now, my article is a bit misleading in as much as it says when Mormons were socialists. Mormons were not capital S socialists, right? They were little S socialists. They didn't even like socialists or capitalists or fascists because they didn't want anyone to compete against their own vision, their own utopia. They were communitarian utopianists. That's the best way to describe them. Very different from the church today. The Mormon Church has assimilated into American culture by rejecting some of these central ideas in the early texts.
And in the early texts, of course, not the prophet, but his successor, Brigham Young, in 1848, declared, there shall be no private ownership of the streams that come out of the canyons, nor the timber that grows on the hills. These belong to the people, all the people.
Yeah.
So the faith has sort of become modern American commercial material. Is there such a thing as Mormon fundamentalists? I don't mean in the polygamous sense, but I mean in the economic sense.
Oh, we've got those too. Absolutely. A lot of progressive Mormons actually see within their sacred texts a reason to actually support, New Deal kind of safety nets for people. They understand that within that there is actually a role for the government to play in taking care of the needy and the sick. Because as great as church charity is, that's not really democratic, right? But when our government steps forward and helps in areas where others can't, we can really infuse that with democracy and actually liberate people from poverty. We've done it in this country again and again and again. And a lot of Mormons vote Democratic because they believe that party best reflects their own spiritual views. That's the story of my dad. My dad was a New Deal Democrat, and he was a Mormon because, first, he was a big old lefty.
Mm-hmm. So where is the why are you so convinced that this guy is a heartless, typical American CEO, survival of the fittest, social Darwinism and all that?
Mostly just observing his behavior at Bain Capital. Again, back to this idea of creative destruction that comes, from breaking things apart, downsizing things, salary cuts, layoffs. He doesn't see that as a problem. It's mostly about getting the money that is needed for his investors. And that's vulture capitalism, whatever you want to call it. I worry that he'll try to run America like he is a CEO.
Right. But, you know, you can make the case, and I've tried in some interviews with guests to make the case that American capitalism itself is in crisis because it's not sustainable in the long run. Capitalism is supposed to be about creating wealth, not extracting it and concentrating it at the top. And he's the archetype of that, you know, and they've rigged America, the 1%, where they don't pay taxes. He only pays 15%. They extract all the wealth they can and then leave the shell companies behind. I think the record's pretty clear on that. Do you expect at some point in the campaign a discussion about the egalitarian roots of Mormonism?
I doubt it. But people like me are going to continue to sort of raise the flag, and we need to continue to have this conversation. I'm really looking forward to seeing what Occupy does this spring and how they push this issue forward. What I want people to know, and what I want people who are involved in the Occupy movement to know, is that they can occupy Zarahemla. They can go to the very sacred Mormon texts that Mitt Romney professes to have a great testimony of, and actually pull out ideas and arguments that actually counter his political worldview. And I encourage everyone to do it.
Well, what about the other interpretation that you mention in your article, Troy Williams at Salon, when Mormons were socialists, that Romney's ascendance to the nation's highest office will affirm to the Mormons that their faith is finally authentic, that they are the indisputable Horatio Alger of American religions?
Right. Well, you know, Mormons they've been sort of the queers, right, of contemporary religious faith. They've been the outsider. They've been the fringe, the outcast. And people have been suspicious of Mormons from the very inception because they were trying to establish a theocratic, political, economic system in the heart of a brand new republic. And they had this, you know, unusual alternative marriage practice, plural marriage that they were trying. So they were persecuted, hated, mobbed, driven across the country till they finally landed in Utah. We all know the history. But that psychologically, I think, has done a lot to Mormons. Mormons want to be accepted. They want to be mainstream. You know, they don't want to be this fringe. They don't want people to look at, watch Big Love and think that this represents them. They're terrified of that. And so to have a front runner, Mitt Romney, to be a Mormon, it's for many Mormons, it says, hey, we've arrived. We're not freaks anymore. And so I very much see this as an issue of assimilation for the Latter-day Saints.
So what about the polygamy issue, though? Is that likely to come up? I mean, his great-grandfather left the United States to go to Mexico because he was a polygamist, and he picked up a fifth wife in Mexico. He's right. Mitt Romney's got cousins down there who live in this commune, this polygamous commune, and they certainly have an uncanny resemblance to him, that kind of square-jawed G.I. Joe look that he has, you know. How's that playing? And when you say Mormons want to be mainstream, is that why they sort of so zealously reject polygamy now?
They do, but ironically and sadly, they still have not disavowed the actual doctrine. I mean, Joseph Smith revealed the doctrine of plural marriage in the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants. This is a book of scripture of Joseph Smith's revelations, and it's canon. And Mormons still today believe in posthumous plural marriages. So hypothetically, in the Mormon worldview, if, God forbid, Ann Romney were to die today, Mitt Romney could go to the Mormon temple and be sealed to a second wife. And that second wife, from his perspective, he would have for all eternity in heaven. So Mormons, while they'll spend millions of dollars pushing Proposition 8 in California, saying marriage should be between one man and one woman, in their sacred holy temples are continuing to marry men polygamously in the hereafter. So they haven't come clean with a lot of these issues.
Well, just in closing then, Troy Williams, there obviously another aspect of Mormonism which the rest of the world, I think, looks askance at, and that is this retroactive baptism. Apparently Adolf Hitler's been baptized as a Mormon, so has Joseph Stalin. Anne Frank was recently. The family of, I think, Elie Wiesel objected. Where does that stand?
Well, I was just reading how Thomas Jefferson had been baptized into the church and then sealed to his first wife, Martha, and then sealed to his slave, Sally Hemings, to whom we know fathered, mothered several of his children. So the Mormons have made Thomas Jefferson, number one, a Mormon, and a polygamist in heaven. And this is bad PR for them, and they have to disavow these practices. Until they do so, it's going to be a source of great embarrassment and a source of... and it's so disrespectful of so many people of so many different faiths. And I think for Mormonism to really grow up and become a mature, authentic religion, they're going to have to deal with this.
Well, when I mentioned earlier, Troy Williams, that I'd not read the Book of Mormon, I did actually try to read the first few pages, and it seemed incredibly violent to me. And I'm aware of the Mount Meather massacre story from... the wagon train of settlers from Arkansas who were massacred by Mormons masquerading as Indians.
Right.
Where does that stand in terms of Mormon consciousness? Has that been brushed under the table?
It's one of those ugly stains. I think the church has a really hard time taking responsibility for their sins. And the Mountain Meadows Massacre is something that is a dark mark on the history of Utah, the history of the Latter-day Saints. And there's been little movements here and there from the church. The church made a lovely, beautiful monument down there, but again, refuses to take responsibility for their actions. It's like the issue with blacks and the priesthood. They say today, in 1978, there was a ban that black men could not hold the Mormon priesthood. And the church says today, well, we don't know why that actual policy was in place. Yes, we do know why that policy is in place. It's because leaders of the church were products of the day. They were racist. And it's okay to admit that, make apologies, and repent of your sins, and move forward. That's what they teach us as little Mormon kids in primary classes and Sunday school, that when you do something wrong, you need to take responsibility for it, make restitution, and repent. And the church has not done that on the issue with Mountain Meadows Massacre or the issue with the blacks and the priesthood. They're not doing it today with gay and lesbian and transgender Mormons either. And I hope that they will.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Troy Williams.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Troy Williams, who's the executive producer of Radioactive, a progressive talk show on KRCL-FM in Salt Lake City. He is a former Mormon missionary who the Salt Lake City Tribune recently named the gay mayor of Salt Lake City. He most recently appeared in the Errol Morris film Tabloid and has an article now at Salon, When Mormons Were Socialists.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.